It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
I was called in at the last minute for Martha McCallum's show on Fox, and I had to race down to the Washington Bureau. And we were talking about what I believe has become a huge national crisis, which is the campus protests, the takeover, virtual takeover of some campuses led by Columbia University, by these pro-Palestinian, by which I mean pro-Gaza, demonstrators. And I'll come back to this, but one of the points I wanted to make was that Joe Biden should own this issue. He has certainly suffered politically by backing Israel, particularly with the progressive wing of his own Democratic Party, and faulted by many for the rising death toll and hunger crisis in Gaza. And anytime that the President of the United States wants, he can step in front of a camera and talk about this. But he has declined to do that. He's refused to do that. He just gives up the bully pulpit. So what happened is that yesterday, or perhaps it was the day before, I've just been so immersed in the news cycle, he responded to a shouted question from a reporter. And you could barely make out what he was saying because there was so much background noise. You know, it's not exactly the ideal way to take a stand on anything. Here's the question. Do you condemn anti-Semitic protests on college campuses? Not exactly a trick question. Biden. I condemn anti-Semitic protests. That's why I set up a program to deal with that. I don't know exactly what program he's talking about. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians and how they're being. And then he got cut off with another question about should the president of Columbia resign? And he said he didn't even know that that was an issue. Okay, so some of my fellow guests on the program said, oh, Biden's doing the both sides thing. He wants to have it both ways. Condemns anti-Semitic protests, okay. Condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. My reading of that was that he was saying these protesters, who obviously are anti-Israel, obviously are pro-Gaza, let's put it that way, they're uninformed. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand the terrorism and the atrocities committed by the Hamas side. But that's not how others saw it. And that's the problem. If you give 1.5 clip sentences, you're open to interpretation. Every commentator in the world can come on and say, oh, no, what Joe Biden meant was this. And the answers, not only was it hard to hear, but it was, you know, almost cryptic. Yes, I condemn anti-Semitic protests. That's great. But how about a little more, Mr. President? All right, we'll come back to that. Because the big story yesterday, of course, story number one, David Pecker's testimony at the Trump trial, the first criminal trial of a former president. And that's been frustrating, too, just because we can't see or hear what's going on in the courtroom. There are obviously reporters there who are sending out messages to their colleagues who are then sharing with us. But, you know, sometimes 10 minutes will go by, nothing. You're just sort of waiting for something to happen. But there is no question, as time went on, that Pecker's testimony, second day on the stand, was pretty damaging to both Donald Trump and Michael Cohen, his former fixer. Pecker, of course, is the former publisher of the National Enquirer, longtime friend of Donald Trump since the 80s. And there were also text messages released that didn't help the former president either. His credibility was widely praised by the media because he had a calm demeanor. He didn't seem angry. He doesn't have the baggage of Michael Cohen, who has been disbarred, who has served time in prison for lying. and whose credibility will be severely challenged when it's his turn to testify. But the details of what Pecker said, it's interesting, because what the prosecutors for Alvin Bragg are trying to do is to paint a pretty lurid picture of especially Donald Trump and his willingness to use and work with and instigate positive reporting about himself by the Inquirer, no shock there, negative reporting about his political opponents starting in 2015. Now, the thing about this, some of this is confirming what we already knew, but you're hearing it from Pecker, except we're not hearing it. Although they've now, the court is now putting out transcripts at the end of the day so that journalists can go over them. And I wish somebody would post these transcripts because I think people who are working during the day or don't have time to sit around waiting for secondhand accounts would click on it. I think it would be a big traffic driver. So it begins. Michael Cohen invites Pecker to come to Trump's down the escalator launch. That's June of 2015. 2 months later, Trump Tower meeting. Pecker, Trump, Cohen. And Pecker is asked, according to his testimony, what can you do and what can your magazines do to help us? And Pecker is all willing to cooperate. He says, I will cooperate in terms of our own coverage, but I will also alert you if I hear of any women, and having been through these cycles before, who are making accusations against Donald Trump, even if it's in another publication. And I will help you with that. And Michael Cohen says, well, I can get those stories killed before they're published. Catch and kill. And by the way, Pecker said he never did catch and kill until Trump and his team asked him to do so. So there were three catch and kill cases. They didn't get to the third one, Stormy Daniels, who, of course, is at the heart of this case. That will be tomorrow. But one involved the doorman, the former doorman of Trump Building, paid $30,000 by the Inquirer, and Pecker has to personally approve any checkbook payments over $10,000 for a wild story about did Donald Trump father a child out of wedlock. And to the Inquirer's credit, the tabloid investigated it, found it was complete and total BS, nothing to it, not a shred of evidence, and therefore didn't publish anything. Now, interestingly, Pecker said that if it had turned out to be true, he wouldn't have published it before the election, but after the election, if it was a big exclusive Trump love child, you know, he would have done it. That's what he says now, at least. Remember, he's testifying under immunity. So he has to be careful about not perjuring himself. The second catch and kill case, Karen McDougal. Unlike Stormy Daniels, who alleges a one-night sexual encounter with Donald Trump, which he denies, Karen McDougal alleges a 10-month affair filled with I love you on both sides. And Trump also denies that. She got paid. She was supposedly negotiating with ABC for a big deal. She got paid $150,000 by the parent company of the Inquirer, AMI. That money going to pay her for writing a fitness column for another AMI publication, not the Inquirer. And I think it is certain that she will testify as well. Now, the thing about all this is, as sleazy as it looks, and we'll get into more of the detail, As sleazy as it looks, it doesn't get to the heart of the case. It's not illegal. It's not illegal to have somebody sign an NDA. It's not illegal to, as Trump's lawyer put it, trying to influence an election. It's what elections are about. What's illegal, according to Alvin Bragg, and it's a pretty thin case, is falsified business records. And even that in and of itself is a misdemeanor. But Bragg stretched it to the lowest class of felony in New York State by tying it to a conspiracy, except Trump is not charged with conspiracy. So you can see how it is really not hard to imagine one juror saying this, you know, causing a hung jury by saying this doesn't cut it. Another point on the Trump defense side would be that both Kara McDougal and Stormy Daniels initiated negotiations to sell their stories, thereby getting Michael Cohen and the Inquirer to step in at a time when they knew Donald Trump would be most vulnerable just before the election, after the Access Hollywood tape. And so if you flip the script and look at it as they were playing defense against, you know, I won't call it extortion because that's a legal charge, but trying to go after a presidential candidate at his most vulnerable point, it starts to look very different. So Assistant DA Josh Steinglass questioning Pecker. Pecker talked about how close he had been with Trump. He even wanted to do a magazine called Trump Style. I guess that did not get off the ground. And Michael Cohen, according to his testimony, would call up and say, we need a negative story on Ted Cruz. He's doing better in the polls. I'll send you some information. And Pecker said, quote, and we'd embellish it from there, leading to this headline, Ted Cruz sex scandal, 5 secret mistresses. Total fake news. Complete and totally bogus. And ironic, to say the least. And everybody remembers the Inquirer cover that said that Ted Cruz's father was tied to Lee Harvey Oswald and the JFK assassination. Here's what Pecker said. We mashed the photos and the different picture with Lee Harvey Oswald. We mashed the two together. And that's how the story was prepared, created, I would say. So he's acknowledging this was complete and total BS. And to the extent, I don't know, that seemed to me it was pretty obviously that it was Photoshopped, but to have a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin, the presidential assassin, and Ted Cruz's father, it's just beyond the pale. Another time, Cohen would call up and say, you know, we need something really negative on Ben Carson. Tease it right up. Bungling surgeon Ben Carson left sponge in patient's brain. I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't so serious. So the doorman got $30,000, as I mentioned. In the case of Karen McDougal, and that one really seemed to bother Trump, Pecker had the Inquirer's editor-in-chief, Dylan Howard, go out to California, interview her, and he found her account at least credible. And Michael Cohen was constantly calling for updates. And Trump was concerned enough to call Pecker himself. Pecker was in a meeting or something, and somebody came over and said, Donald Trump is trying to reach you. Pecker said, we should buy and suppress the story. We should catch and kill with Karen McDougal. Trump was opposed to that. Not out of any, you know, sense of morality, but again, according to Pecker's testimony, saying that when you do that, it always comes out and you look worse. But Pecker insisted. So the Inquirer arranged that $150,000 payment to Karen McDougal to write this column. So the media have been praising Pecker, saying he's credible, he was calm, he's not like Michael Cohen. And the testimony was pretty damaging because it has Trump sort of in on it at the beginning, making the request, and Pecker going all in, doing everything he could to try to elect Donald Trump, in part by keeping negative stories out of not just his own publication, but others. The day actually began with a hearing on the gag order. Now, anybody looking at this will see that Donald Trump continued to publish on Truth Social or say or repost attacks on Michael Cohen and attacks on Stormy Daniels, both of whom will be key witnesses in the trial. So Bragg's office said there were 10 different violations of the gag order and that the penalty for that would be $1,000 each. So I know Trump is strapped for cash right now, but $10,000 is a rounding error to him. You know, the judge, Juan Merchan, made a particular point of saying, we're not asking for jail time or anything like that, $10,000. But it went on and on, and the prosecutors came in and they went, you know, tried to start going point by point as to the different instances in which the gag order had been violated. And then Todd Blanche, Trump's lawyer, he had a pretty weak hand to play. He came in, he said, no, absolutely no willful violation, blah, blah, blah. And Merchan got more and more and more exasperated. He said it was silly to assume the gag order was somehow waived because Trump had been attacked. Trump's argument, and he made this when he came out, is Stormy Daniels can attack me, Michael Cohen can go on TV and attack me, and I can't respond. This is unconstitutional. Merchan kept saying, show me specific instances of what Cohen or Stormy said. And Todd Blanche didn't do that. And finally, he raised his voice, and the judge said, you're losing all credibility with the court. You've presented nothing. Now, he didn't make a decision, but it's pretty obvious which way he's going to go.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Little bit of the coverage. National Enquirer was more than a friendly media outlet for Donald Trump, says the New York Times. It was a powerful national political weapon thrust into the service of a single candidate by the omission of the Enquirer's own publisher, first made to prosecutors years ago. You know, under the First Amendment, this piece says newspapers are permitted to support candidates, but the Enquirer's support went beyond journalism. Okay, understatement of the century. And then it recounts the catch and kill instances. And, you know, you're not allowed to donate as a company more than $4,400 per person. And you can't coordinate with them. So those are sort of, you know, FEC violations. And by the way, the Federal Election Commission did hit at that period of time the Enquirer's parent company with $187,000 in fines. I did not recall that. Trump National Press Secretary, Campaign Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt on Sean Hannity last night. After sitting in that dirty, disgusting criminal courtroom today, watching the former president of the United States be persecuted like a criminal, I don't know if I'm so proud to be an American anymore. Meanwhile, there are real criminals running free in the streets of this city every single day, being released by the same Democrat prosecutor who's going after President Trump. It's a tremendous waste of taxpayer dollars. It's a tremendous waste of time. But the problem is, when you say he's being treated like a criminal, and you can argue that the case is bogus and partisan, and I have said 100 times it's the weakest and most partisan case. But he is a criminal defendant, and that's why he's being treated like this. Meanwhile, Marjorie Taylor Greene said the Democrats want Donald Trump to be, and I'm quoting here, murdered in jail. She's talking to Alex Jones, the Sandy Hook conspiracy theorist, the InfoWars host. And she said this is an intentional effort by his political rivals to imprison Trump until he dies. And here's Mitt Romney's verdict. You know, Mitt, not so much known for making spicy comments. So far as I know, you don't pay someone $130,000 not to have sex with you. No love lost there. Story number two, I think this is an important story. Politico has a piece. It's going to sound a little bit like Inside Baseball, but stay with me. How a whole bunch of legal analysts and anti-Trump pundits secretly have a Zoom call once a week in which they go over all Trump developments, particularly the trials, every Friday. Now, who's involved? Well, the host is Norman Eisen, senior Obama official, and CNN legal analyst. He's been doing this since 2022. He was also a member of the team of lawyers assembled by House Democrats to handle Trump's first impeachment. So, some of the bold-faced names on the call: Bill Kristol, Lawrence Tribe, the famous law professor, John Dean of Watergate fame, George Conway, ex-husband of Kellyanne, conservative lawyer who's constantly on MSNBC now, and co-founder of the Lincoln Project, Andrew Weissman, who worked for Bob Mueller on the Russia investigation and is brought on, you know, as if he's just a neutral party. So, for example, sometimes as a guest. On one Friday, after the E. Jean Carroll victory in that defamation and sexual assault civil suit, E. Jean's lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, joined as a guest to talk about her strategy for beating Trump for half an hour. Another time, retired Judge J. Michael Luttig, who led the campaign for Trump to be kicked off the ballot under the 14th Amendment, which the Supreme Court did not allow, showed up as one of the guests. Now, there's a history of this, sure. And, you know, I mean, you can go to, on the campaign trail, you can go to any bar and see a bunch of journalists, you know, talking off the record, comparing notes and so forth. But because this is organized on Zoom among people who are almost completely anti-Trump, I mean, for example, Barbara McQuaid, former prosecutor, constantly on MSNBC. Joyce Vance, former prosecutor, constantly on MSNBC. Harry Littman, columnist for the LA Times. Jennifer Rubin, anti-Trump opinion writer for the Washington Post. Mary McCord, I see her all the time on MS, former prosecutor, former DOJ official, co-hosts a podcast on MSNBC, and on and on and on. Elliot Williams, former prosecutor, provides commentary on CNN, a former FBI special agent, Asha Rangappa, ABC News contributor, and on and on and on and on. Now, the author tries to be fair, saying, well, you know, they don't always agree, and it's not like they're just handing out the talking points. It's not a heavy-handed PR strategy, one participant saying, because everybody's off the record. It's rare that somebody says, well, I think this is a better argument for us, or I think this is a stupid argument that we shouldn't be making. Do some of the people on the call align their positions as a result of discussions? Yes, probably. That can sound nefarious, but it's also the natural result of a group discussion. Okay, I would just say it looks horrible. It confirms the darkest suspicions of every conservative, that this is all coordinated, that the pundits all get together, that they say different versions of the same thing, and it is coordinated, and they do this every Friday, and it's off the record. It just is playing into the hands, now that it's been exposed, of conservatives. Let me move on to story three. Joe Biden could have been talking about campus protests yesterday, but instead he went to Florida. You know, this isn't a White House that shifts gears very well. So this has been planned as Abortion Day, Kamala Harris was talking about abortion. She's a natural messenger for the administration on that. And the reason Biden went to Florida was to denounce Ron DeSantis' six-week abortion ban, which goes into effect in just days. Even Donald Trump had said that that was went too far. There's one person who's responsible for this nightmare, said the president. He's acknowledged and he's bragged about it. It's Donald Trump. So look, Florida's become a red state. Democrats have lost ground. They believe the abortion issue will galvanize voters, even in Florida. Doesn't mean Biden will win Florida. He almost definitely will not. But it might help some down-ballot candidates. Biden. Donald Trump is worried voters are going to hold him accountable for the cruelty and chaos he created. Folks, the bad news for Trump is we are going to hold him accountable. Now, obviously, Democrats who've won every time this has come to some kind of referendum, the Democrats have won since the overturning of Roe. Even in such GOP states like Kentucky, Kansas, Ohio. Biden called the Florida law bizarre, but said that, you know, women are going to turn out in November to restore those rights for the women of America. This isn't about states' rights, it's about women's rights. Oh, Trump called the DeSantis law too harsh when last he commented on it. But that was before he said it's up to the states. And the problem is when you say it's up to the states, you own everything. If there's a complete and total ban in some states, you're saying that's fine, it's up to the states. If there's an Arizona 1864 draconian law, up to the states. And if there's a six-week ban in Florida, up to the states. But Biden, who's a practicing Catholic, you know, sometimes is not that comfortable talking about this. He said during a fundraiser last year, I'm not big on abortion.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, let's come back to the campus protests. Story number four. So at Columbia, which authorized the NYPD to come in and arrest, I think, more than 100 protesters last week, they've let the protesters come back and set up even more tents than before. They've now gone to remote learning for the rest of the year or hybrid learning. How many Jewish students do you think are going to feel comfortable now going onto campus? And oh, they were going to get tough. They're negotiating with these protesters. They set a midnight deadline, meaning last night, for the protesters to disband or the police would come in. But that didn't happen. About 3 a.m., university put out a statement saying student protesters had agreed to remove a significant number of the tents erected on the lawn. This is private property. To ensure that non-students would leave and bar discriminatory or harassing language among the protesters is already. I mean, they are saying to Jewish students, every day will be October 7th for you. There'll be 10 October 7ths. There'll be 100 October 7ths. And burn down Tel Aviv, and just the worst kind of anti-Semitism. I'm sorry, this is not, hey, we think there are too many deaths in Gaza and we oppose that. They support Hamas. Oh, in light of this constructive dialogue, the university will continue conversations for the next 48 hours. I mean, this to me means the protesters have won. They have essentially shut down Columbia University, which is keep setting deadlines and not doing anything. And you could go in and arrest all these people right now. Also today, I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but Speaker Mike Johnson expected to arrive at the campus to talk to Jewish students about the troubling rise in anti-Semitism. Some of the protesters say that the National Guard might be called in, but New York Governor Kathy Hochul said that's not happening. There are encampments now at Tufts, at Emerson, at UC Berkeley. Arrests continued at other schools. Washington Post reporting University of Minnesota police moved in at the request of the school, arrested 9 people, cleared the tents. Monday night, police moved in at New York University. Made a bunch of arrests. Also, at Yale University, bunch of arrests. California State Polytechnic University went into a lockdown after students, protesters, barricaded themselves inside a building. I'm sorry. They've wimped out. They've lost. And then there's more detail about what happened in Minnesota. Just unbelievable. And at NYU, some of the protesters were linking arms and sitting on the ground or sitting on the ground chanting, "Free Palestine, long live Gaza." The deputy police commissioner told Fox 5 in New York, there were about 10 to 15 faculty members that had tied their hands together in a chain. And they were the most aggressive toward police officers. The most aggressive. And so, this is a national crisis. Now, on the positive side, the Senate yesterday passed, and President Biden will sign today, and here I think he will go on television, that's the plan, the aid that Mike Johnson pushed through, and he deserves a lot of credit, even though he created the problem in the first place. And there's a lot of stories about how the administration didn't criticize Mike Johnson, gave him room to maneuver, worked with him, worked with Democrats who were going to help him get across the finish line, particularly on aid to Ukraine, which was done as a separate package and got bipartisan support. Aid to Israel, overwhelming bipartisan support. Aid to Taiwan. And meanwhile, the donors, such as Robert Kraft, said he's not giving another penny to Colombia. He doesn't recognize the school anymore. Look, I got my journalism degree at Columbia. I don't recognize the school anymore. Dan Abrams, who went to Columbia Law School, said on the air that he's ashamed to have gone to Columbia. And I'm kind of feeling that way too now. I was hopeful when the arrests were made, and now it's just like you've totally caved. You've made Jewish students feel unwelcome, unwanted, harassed, and you haven't, and you've lost control of your campus. The sister school, Barnard, this will give you the idea of how bad things have gone. President of Barnard says she's going to lift suspensions for the anti-Israel campus protesters after receiving public criticism from Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, whose daughter was among those suspended. If you didn't have a previous record of misconduct and you follow the rules, you have your suspension listed. And by the way, any faculty member who walked off the job in order to protest, I think should be fired. Where do you think a lot of students get these views from? This is what they're taught in the classroom. And finally, story number 5 will be very brief today. George Santos, who came up with the idea after being criminally indicted, after being expelled by a House of Representatives controlled by the Republicans, has dropped his bid to run again for his old seat. And the reason? He has raised $0. Not one person would give a dime to this serial fabricator who is facing a potential prison term once this case goes to trial, unless it is settled. And even then, he can be facing a potential prison term. So, you know, Santos, I'll be back, and he's always got something to spin, keep himself in the news. $0. See you, George. Hey, thanks so much for staying with me. A lot to cover these days, as you can tell. I try to stay on top of as much as I can. I can't always fit everything in. I wanted to go more into the bipartisan effort on aid to Ukraine and Israel. We'll come back to that. A lot of these stories aren't going away. See you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.